I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
When John F. Kennedy made that speech to Congress in May of 1961, he set a clear goal to land a man on the moon before the end of 1969. It was a Herculean task, and it gave the United States less than a decade to achieve it. While much has been said about the moon landing, it would not have happened without the ongoing support of the taxpaying public and members of Congress. And neither would have been possible without one critical thing: marketing. The moonshot had to be consistently sold to the public in order for Americans to continue supporting the project. And members of Congress had to be persuaded to continue allocating budgets on what was to become one of the most expensive endeavors in U.S. history. It would take creativity, strategy, fear, patriotism, and persuasion. But there was no getting around it. It was time to market the moon.
Joanne Harvey lifted her space helmet from her shoulders and gently hooked it on an aluminum rack. Although her face was drawn and troubled, she forced a wan smile.
Bruce, I'd advise you not to let Captain McAllister hear you complain like that. Those algae cakes are his pride and joy.
But they taste like cardboard.
This is cardboard if I ever tasted it.
He keeps saying he's... Let me have that horse a taste. He keeps saying he's worked out a formula that makes them taste like Italian pizza, but they still taste like cardboard.
Fatty Fanjul, have an algae cake.
The girl sat down and expertly removed her weighted space boots. She sighed heavily.
Nothing like space boots to make a young woman psychiatrist resemble a baby elephant. Say, isn't it your turn to go on duty as always every day?
I have a little suggestion just as a prologue into this about...
Go to the moon, go to the moon.
Right, exactly that.
Get off the earth and go to the moon. Yes, go away, go away, go to the moon. Take your streets and houses and stop signs and all your police.
Go to the moon.
Armies, go to the moon. Go to the moon, we'll help, we'll pay our taxes. We'll send you to the moon, we'll send you to the moon. We want you to go to the moon. Ho, ho, you'll love it up there because it's all clean and there's no dust and you have to cut all the hair off all your body everywhere and you'll all dress in plastic suits and have plastic furniture and plastic houses. And you'll love it on the moon, you'll love it on the moon, you'll love it on the moon, and we'll all stay here and be happy. Oh, boy.
They're up, sir, and I have a message from Major Manson for you. When they reached the thermal tube, Captain Harvey wasn't there, so the Major and Joanne are going to search for him. He told me to advise you not to spend too much time with your giant rabbits.
That's all, sir. Thanks a lot, Bucky. There's another rabbit. Come here, Bob. Ah, got him.
Got him right in his rabbit hat.
I know. Rabbits are always susceptible, you know, to being asked a direct question.
Right.
That's the way to stop a rabbit if it's attacking you. You say, you know, like, what's the capital of Guatemala? And the rabbit will stop and try and think of the answer.
And then you punch him right in the head. Just like I did to be in fifth grade geology, right?
Yeah, we used to
what
have
kind
a
of rock is this?
I don't know,
Miss Uterus.
That's a hard rock. It's called a metamorphic rock. See that blood?
Squeak! 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 Where are you?
Murmured the girl, nervously biting on her lower lip. She slowly pivoted in midair and stared at the distant earth, a hazy blue globe dangling in an ebony sky. Her brother might never walk on that friendly dirt again. The slender young flight doctor shuddered. Despite the controlled warmth of her spacesuit, there was no friendly soil on the moon. Nothing but sterile, gray-brown dust.
Give me some good night soil.
I'm going to go over here and make some friendly soil. I'll be right back.
Monotonous craters.
Why, look at the sky.
And sawtooth mountains the color of rust.
Oh, I just made a pile on a sawtooth mountain. Why didn't somebody tell me?
Stop slamming that obelisk.
Hey, if you don't go to the moon, if you're really unhappy and you don't want to go to the moon, the other suggestion I have is do it the
If you're really happy and you don't want to go to the
if
moon.
If you're really happy and you don't want to go to the moon, but you want to find out where paradise is, this is the decade of finding out where paradise is, travel. Go everywhere. Absolutely. And remember, every place that's supposed to be dirty and lazy and unfriendly is paradise.
Right,
every
like
place
Los Angeles.
Right, right. Every place is supposed to be clean and together, like Beirut.
Kennedy employed two main tactics in his marketing plan to sell the moon. The first was the use of his New Frontier theme.
Some would say that those struggles are all over, that all the horizons have been explored, that all the battles have been won, that there is no longer an American frontier. But I trust that no one in this assembly would agree with that sentiment. For the problems are not all solved, and the battles are not all won. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier.
Kennedy's campaign platform suggested his youth and vitality would lead America into a new era, an era that seemed light years away from the grandfatherly President Eisenhower. The space program became the centerpiece of his New Frontier vision. I hear you're mad about Ruby. Like your eyes, I like him too.
He's an artist, a pioneer. We've got to have some music on the new frontier.
Because it encompassed optimism, it advanced science and technology, it defined the future, it called upon the American values of courage, sacrifice, and independence, and above all, it was a crisp demarcation point between old and new. As author James L. Kaufman points out in his superbly researched book entitled Selling Outer Space, human beings are storytelling animals. We find purpose and guidance through the understanding stories provide. Among the most important stories in the U.S. is the myth of the old frontier.
Scalp 'em, Tantric.
Ruby, Kimasabi.
Hi ho, electric blue! Away!
Ranger's on a bum trip again. Howdy, Brahmachari. I'm Gabby, your sacred cowboy. You know, this reminds me very little of the time my guru sent me out to clean up the karma in Artful Dodge City. I stumped into the Last Chance Saloon.
Paramahansa Yogan and a party boo.
Give me some more of that third red eye, Barky.
You've had it. That's your last chant, cowboy. Out!
There was a passel of them theosophists at the other end of the bar raising the devil. Had him about 10 feet off the floor. And I could tell by the red clay on his hooves and his black aura that he was up to no good. So I look him straight in the eye and I said, Sam Paku, there ain't enough room in this life cycle for both of us. That little devil up and challenged me to a game of 10-card tarot, Pentacles Wild. I seed him deal a high priestess from the bottom of the deck, and then...
Columbia! Ho! Columbia! Ho!
It's Lieutenant Behind of the 7th Seal Cavalry.
I need 3 men! 1 from Columbia, and 2 from Columbia! Drop! Hoop!
Howdy, Lieutenant Behind. What's up?
We ain't. Got some more loco weed?
Sure. Got some road apple red right here.
Which way'd we go?
You went that away.
Thank you.
America has relied heavily on the frontier for its mythic identity. The conquest of the Western wilderness is a story that celebrates the rugged, independent hero who ultimately tamed the land and improved his way of life.
Boy, I'm tired of pushing west. How long ago we leave Goshen?
About 2 hours ago. Ever gonna stop?
Not quite done, old boys. Wagon boss.
My fellow settlers, hold it down. We stand here at the edge of civilization, on the banks of the Mississippi River, looking west at our destiny. What may appear to the faint-hearted as a limitless expanse of God-forsaken wilderness
is
in reality a golden opportunity for humble, God-fearing people like ourselves and our families and our children and the generations are coming to carve a new life out of the American Indian.
Welcome, white brother.
Injuns! Draw the wagons up into our circle!
Why do you always do that?
We get better reception that way. Do you mind if I put this antenna up on yonder peak?
That's our sacred mountain.
This is our sacred antenna. It's shaped like a cross. Made out of aluminum. Got any aluminum?
We've still got some corn left.
Hey, corn! Now we can make whiskey!
We've been waiting hundreds of years for this!
Just invented a Tom Collins.
Here, Injun, you want some fire water?
No. We were warned by our elders not to drink anything that would make us weak or silly.
Put it in their well.
That's not a well. It's the eye of the Holy Serpent Mound on which you're standing.
It's a butte.
No, it's a mound.
And right purty, too. Can you move it?
But why?
Railroad's coming through. Right now.
Hey, what we stopping for?
We in Goshen yet?
Can't go no further. This here's Injun territory.
Well then, it's treaty time!
My fellow Redskins, speaking for the great white father in Washington and all the American people, let me say we respect you, savages, for your native ability to instantly adapt and survive in whatever godforsaken wilderness we move you to. Out there, sign here.
They did it!
No reason to complain. It's not so bad out there. We still have our people and our ceremonies and the sun, moon, and stars and the sand and the black stuff coming out of the ground.
Black stuff coming out of the ground?
Civilization! Ho!
That heroic storyline holds much resonance for Americans. So, when Kennedy pointed to space as the newest frontier,
confess your passion, the secret fear. Prepare to meet the challenge of the new frontier.
It gave Americans a way to attach meaning to space exploration. The moonshot, JFK said, also had beneficial byproducts. It would deliver across-the-board scientific advances that would be felt by every American in their schools, in their businesses, and right in their own homes. There was also another aspect of the frontier narrative that would give the goal its urgency. It placed a premium on being first.
Super Jam. It really, when I say that, that's what I mean. Okay. Because there's not going to be any opening acts or headliners, none of that crap. Oh, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, there's just going to be three headliners, three super groups.
Fine. As long as they're all headliners, they're all
equal billing. Equal billing.
Fine with me. Why don't we just list them in the order they appear, huh? Make it easy for everyone.
Dynamite.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Let's start with the first act, shall we?
Fine.
Okay. Who's on first?
Look, if my girl already called you with the information, you know, I'm wasting my time being here.
No.
I could be booking Sly up in Seattle in a month.
No, I said, who's on first?
That's right.
That's right. Ooh, what a nice name.
No, excuse me. That's wrong.
That's defiant. That's wrong.
Mr. Hickenlooper, it's not that's right. Mm-hmm. It's not that's wrong.
Well, then who's on first?
Who's on first?
Who is on first?
Who is on first?
Who?
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 Who's on first?
That's right.
That's right. I've got that down here.
Look, Mr. Hickenlooper, you go into Ontario Motor Speedway, you sit down, the man comes out on stage, he takes the microphone, he says, ladies and gentlemen, Conquest Concerts is proud to present who?
Who?
That's right.
That's right. That's right. Wait a minute. Here's a suggestion.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion.
Fine.
Why don't we start with the second act, and then we'll go back. We can go back. That's right.
It's fine with me, sir. Fine with me.
Fine.
I happen to be double parked outside.
All right,
you know,
well, then...
I can afford the ticket, but let's move on.
Fine, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
What's the name of the second act?
Guess who? Guess who?
The Dingling Sisters.
The Dingling Sisters? First of all, they're not even sisters.
I didn't know.
But more importantly, we're talking about big time rock and roll. Guess who?
I can't guess who.
You don't have to guess who.
Then I won't guess who.
So don't guess who.
All right.
Well,
glad to see that we do see eye to eye on something.
I'll tell you something, Mr. Hickenlooper. I didn't have this much trouble with the Free Press.
Oh, well, I didn't have this much trouble with the Music Center, and they put on Rigoletto 1 year.
Well, that's four acts.
I don't count the acts. I listen to the music. All right, let's just move on to the third act. I don't know why I didn't suggest this to begin with. We'll start with the third. We can always go back.
Fine with me.
Will you please tell me the name of the third act?
Yes.
Fine.
Great. Let me see a proof of that ad. By Wednesday, we'll be in business.
Wait a minute! Come back here! I asked you to tell me the name of the third act.
I told you the name of the third act. You want me to tell you again?
Yes!
That's right!
That's right, on first.
Who's on first? Guess who's on second and the third act?
Yes?
That's right!
The second strategy Kennedy used to market the importance of sending a man to the moon was fear. In order to persuade Congress to approve massive expenditures, Kennedy framed the argument by saying dramatic results in space meant nothing less than world leadership.
Over the years, as he thought about Spook's scheme, Ballinger would come to see some deeper meaning than just the foolishness it at first seemed. The scheme was this. The world, Spook told him, was controlled by women. This was something that Ballinger was old enough to be aware of. But, Spook pointed out, women were controlled by the moon. That was well known. Ballinger did not know if this was technically true, but given his obscured knowledge of women, he certainly thought it had some merit as an idea. It seemed positively Shakespearean, in fact. Ergo, said Spook, although this was perhaps not the exact word he used, control the moon and you will control women. Control women and you will control the affairs of men. Control the affairs of men and you will effectively control the world. There was a graceful elegance to this argument that seemed unassailable then, although in later years it came to seem to him quite assailable. Still, it retained for Ballinger over his long life an ineffable air of wisdom and mystery.
Acutely aware of image, he explained that supremacy in space would influence the other nations of the world who were deciding whether to align themselves with the U.S. or the USSR. Furthermore, America could not permit the Soviets to dominate space with hostile intentions.
For the eyes of the world now look into space, and we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom.
Vice President Johnson put an even finer point on it, saying that America couldn't afford to let the Soviets drop bombs on them from space, like kids dropping rocks on cars from a freeway overpass.
Explain to me, because you love me, how to make and play poo sticks.
Yes. This is really good, man. Poo sticks is where you get a bridge with a river running under it, and all the players have different sticks, you dig, that they can recognize what the sticks are, what kind it is. And then you get on one side of the bridge, right, and you drop the sticks in the water, and then you run over to the other side of the bridge, and the stick that comes through first wins. It's one of the finest non-competitive games I know.
And as I was saying, whoever controls the high ground of space will control the world. The Roman Empire controlled the world because it could build roads. Later, the British Empire was dominant because it had ships. In the air stage, we were powerful because we had the airplane. Now, the communists have established a foothold in outer space. Pretty soon, they have damn space platforms up there to drop nuclear bombs on us, like rocks from a highway overpass. Now, how in the hell did they ever get ahead of us?
Congress actually didn't need much convincing because no other event had a greater influence on them or caused more panic than the Soviet surprise orbit of the Earth. President Kennedy asked Congress to commit to a 5-year plan, beginning with the approval of a $1.7 billion NASA budget in 1961, which Congress happily did. NASA had limited ways to speak directly to the American public, so it sought out a partnership with a major media outlet. It chose Life magazine.
Life. That's what Billville's about. All kinds of life. Teeming baculums.
Narrow-eyed dinglebeaks.
Riots of tick lilies.
Instincted hinks.
Engorged gumstones hibernating under heaving fields of numbing hemp.
And people.
Don't forget the people.
The deal with Life gave the magazine exclusive rights to the astronauts' personal stories, their wives, their children, and their home lives. In return, it gave NASA a glossy weekly vehicle to project a very carefully constructed image. The astronauts hired Henry Batten as their agent. He was the head of the NW Air advertising agency. Batten negotiated a 3-year contract with Life magazine that was worth $500,000. It was a mind-boggling number for the Mercury 7. Distributed equally, it meant $70,000 per man. For astronauts earning around $7,000 a year, it was 10 times their annual salary. Batten also negotiated one other stipulation. Each astronaut was given a $100,000 life insurance policy. That was critically important to their families, as no insurance company would underwrite an astronaut. It was a big coup for Life to land exclusive rights to the Mercury 7, and competitors complained loudly. But for Life, it was a survival strategy, as the magazine was battling fiercely with television for advertising dollars, and its sales were falling. But the magazine's power was pictures. Its pages were bigger than all other periodicals, and it presented the astronauts to the nation in stunning, full-color, multi-page pictorials. Even though Life had the appearance of an objective weekly magazine, in reality, NASA maintained strict approval power over all articles and photographs. Life magazine essentially became an arm of NASA's PR department. Staff writers, lorded over by NASA, produced a uniform image of the Mercury 7 as unblemished heroes. It ghostwrote articles on behalf of the wives to appeal to female readers.
Hey, brother, I was just remembering with Regular here that dream I told you about, the one everyone had all at the same time. You know, all those real sharp chicks and like it was on the moon or something.
I remember you told me.
And Life photographers captured endless moments of colorful family bliss. NASA wanted perfect astronauts, perfect astro wives, perfect children, and perfect homes. Life magazine didn't disappoint. In 1963, the first real opposition to the space program was voiced. Critics pushed for cheaper unmanned flights. Others asked if the fantastical cost would take away from Department of Defense budgets. Scientists questioned the technological benefits of a moon landing. Hearing the pushback, NASA jumped into marketing mode. It began sending NASA officials and astronauts out on speaking tours, to promote the remarkable technology being developed and why it demanded manned space travel. It created Space Mobile, a museum on wheels that crisscrossed the nation. It sent out films to television networks. The press also supported the call for manned space flights, not just because they bought into Kennedy's frontier theme. They knew astronauts sold more magazines, newspapers, and rating points. NASA could also recruit the president to help when the critics got too loud. In mid-1963, JFK went on a tour of space facilities to call attention to the program and made this speech at one of the stops.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It was one of Kennedy's most forceful speeches. Yet, privately, Kennedy was fretting about the mounting costs. While the bravado of the moonshot solved his immediate public relations problem, the fiscal reality was beginning to sink in. The ballooning NASA costs were, in his words, wrecking his budgets. So, in September of 1963, Kennedy shocked Washington with a speech to the United Nations by proposing a joint U.S.-Soviet moon expedition.
Finally, in a field where the United States and the Soviet Union have a special capacity in the field of space, there is room for new cooperation, for further joint efforts in the regulation and exploration of space. I include among these possibilities a joint expedition to the moon.
Well, this is a real song. This really happened to me in Russia after I'd grown up a little bit. And all you really need to know is that you're in Lvov, in a pocket park with your Lvover, and the old Chelovek comes by with his bell, Kalikala, and you're closing in on her, and it's closing time.
The bell was ringing, it was dark, the park was closing, still she held onto my arm. She was a peasant girl, a pleasant girl, and yes, she drove a tractor on a farm. And as the summer night began, and as the trolley sparked that ran on silver tracks in circles round and round the park, she held my hand, Manhattan hand, and whispered low her five-year plan. Then we depart. Oh, Moscow memories, you haunt me still. Communist memories erode my will.
Congress was stunned. In one fell swoop, Kennedy seemed to completely reverse his administration's reason for beating the Soviets to the moon. Without the appeal to national security, Congress would have cut the budget in half. As James Kaufman points out, that deep-seated fear of Soviet space domination even explained the lack of partisanship in the committee. Both parties had voted enthusiastically for space budgets. It was the primary reason Congress was urging NASA not just to go to the moon, but hurry to the moon. The Soviets never replied to Kennedy's invitation. The Congress subcommittee cut $600 million from the 1963 budget, which many believe was its way of punishing Kennedy for suggesting the Soviet partnership.
And now so many years have passed, and here I sit on Wall Street and recall that in my younger days I kissed a communist, a red-haired Russian lass. Oh, Moscow melodies, you haunt me still. Marxist memories destroy my will. Now the government has asked me please to sign my name to papers just to siphon off a little of my cash. To fight a war, support a horror, close a park, or build an ark in space, or buy the president some hash.
But in spite of that admonishment, Congress still approved a whopping $5.1 billion budget. With the mounting press criticism, the sudden lack of faith from Congress, and NASA looking to him to right the ship, Kennedy went back out on the road to resell the moonshot. With one eye on the upcoming 1964 election, Kennedy went to Cape Canaveral and other southern space facilities to promote and call renewed attention to the goal of being the first nation to land a man on the moon. That trip would eventually take him to Dallas. Optimism of Apollo 7 kicked the NASA marketing machine into high gear. By that time, the command center had moved from Cape Canaveral in Florida to the Manned Space Center in Houston. It became a national attraction by 1968, drawing over 800,000 visitors, compared to the 500,000 people who visited the Grand Canyon that year. The renewed energy of the space program encouraged marketers to jump on the Apollo bandwagon. If a product had any tie-in with the missions, no matter how tenuous, it happily advertised the fact. Like a product I remember eating called Pillsbury Space Food Sticks.
Today, the United States is engaged in a gigantic effort to send men to the moon. For this effort, Pillsbury has developed many special foods.
The Earth, among the stars. And its banner shall be a sign of fire. And its kitchen will be open noon to noon. And none shall go away unfull. Even if we have to eat the moon.
Eat the moon.
Even if we have to eat the moon.
Eat the moon.
Even if we have to eat the moon.
Well, let's eat the moon.
This is a progressive jazz show.
Even if we have to eat the moon.
Rolo!
If we have to eat the moon. Eat the moon.
Sometimes you feel like, you know, you feel like the moon has been eaten away.
So the asteroid hits the moon, and it destroys the moon. Now, it doesn't destroy the planet. It just, like, creates a ring of, like, debris around the planet. The wobble of the Earth goes wonky. Tides are no more. We don't have a moon.
It all began 3 years ago when Daddy, who fancies himself, when no one is looking, something of an astronomer, turned his telescope on the moon, and then for some strange reason became obsessed with that pale mistress of the sky.
I see.
He began stealing it in a small way, once a month. Oddly, no one seemed to notice. Then he became bolder and bolder.
Yes, I remember meeting him when I was a rock.
He kept it then for longer and longer periods of time. We never knew what he did with it. I warned him that people would begin to notice, but he took no heed.
Hasn't taken any since Mother got him off the stuff. That reminds me, Beeson, it is time for my shot. Ha ha, you blind fool, you missed again. Yes, and look at the hole you put in the back of the wall of the shop. Oh, homeless, what's that voice? Doctor, come here quickly and look through this hole. What do you see?
I see a large white pitted object.
Oh, Ian, he's discovered the large white pitted object in our backyard. Daddy will be furious.
Come, Detson, let's get to the bottom of this.
Oh, homeless, do you realize what that large white pitted object is?
Yes, Jetsam. It's incredible. Do you realize that over 500,000 babies were born today all over the world with their sun in Sagittarius and their moon in Glasgow?
Hey, you! Get your filthy hands off me moon!
You smudge it! Just a second, old man. What do you mean, your moon? The moon belongs to everyone.
And the best things in life are real.
So you sing. But what do they do? Do they look at it? Do they make love under it?
I like to imagine some cut scenes where people are trying to have a romantic evening and they can't make it happen because there's no moon.
Yeah, that whole That's Amore would be like a shit song now.
Yeah.
When the moon hits your eye, it's out.
So in your idea, the show's pro is that you imagine a comedy scene where there's a couple who are like, oh, we can't be romantic because of our moon is gone.
Do they write songs about it? No. They hurl dirty great machines at it, that's what they do. They come down in a whoosh of flame, scorching its tender skin, wounding it, and wreaking havoc in the sea of tranquility. Then they stripe at it and make it bleed, and then they take pictures of the carnage they have done. Well, it's all in the past now, because I'm taking good care of it, me.
Sir, in the name of the Queen, I must ask you to return the moon to its rightful place in the heavens.
Did you say the Queen?
Did I say the what?
The Queen.
Oh, yes, I did. Oh, you just said it too.
Oh.
The Queen.
Get on with it, Father.
Of course I did.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
In that case, as a gentleman, I can only comply. However, there is one condition.
What is that, old man?
That I be allowed to go along with it, to protect it from the madness of this world.
But, Daddy, how will you live?
Unpretentiously. Goodbye, children.
Goodbye, Daddy.
Well, well, homeless. Another case has been solved by your brilliant... Homeless? Homeless lad, where are you?
I'm off with the moon, Doctor!
But why?
Because I'm going to solve the greatest case of my career, the mystery of the universe!
If I were a Cambodian soldier...
You are a Cambodian soldier!
I would have been blazing away at an eclipse of the moon with the other guys. And you know, this happened Sunday night.
No.
I'm a Cambodian soldier. Oh, I'm so confused. War is stupid. As a Cambodian soldier, I'm shooting at an eclipse of the moon because I believe that Riho, the mythological monster, eats the moon. Sometimes I see him as a dragon. Other times as a giant frog. And he's eating the moon because its head was cut off by the god Vishnu. So I'm going to shoot at it. That's why war is stupid and crazy. We're wasting bullets on the moon.
We should be shooting the sun.
That's all I have to say.
We should be trying to shoot down the sun, you know, because if we shot the sun down, you know, then all the Chinese would freeze to death, you know?
Now you're talking.
I hope so. My mouth is moving and air is coming through my larynx. If I'm not talking, then I'm crazy, you know, and I don't want to be crazy.
You're not crazy, you're a Cambodian.
That's right, you know. You know why we shot at the moon?
Armenian.
No, you don't. You know why we shot at the eclipse?
No.
To make it go away. You know what happened?
What?
It went away. Yes, it did. You can think that, it left us. The boys began to cry. You know, Cambodian soldiers, when they get deserted by something as important as the moon, can ruin their spirit.
Big shadow of the sun comes down, comes round. You know, you can't always be sure when the sun and the earth, that's the place we call home. You can't be sure when they're in a line and when the moon is in a line. Sometimes a great big bite goes right out of the moon. She seems diminished, seems smaller, goes red. But it's still the moon.
Still the moon.
The moon's our friend. Goes around the earth.
Your friend is the guy that goes around with you, Dave.
Almost every new product with a link to the Apollo program advertised itself as a space age innovation.
As America steps out into space, we're discovering ways to pack delicious meals into new forms. Such a discovery is new Carnation Instant Breakfast. Gives your family vitamin C, the fresh orange juice vitamin, as much protein as two fresh eggs, as much mineral nourishment as two strips of crisp bacon, plus more energy than two slices of buttered toast.
Is Professor Zygote still in his secret laboratory?
Yes, he shut himself in there for 5 days working on his new biochemical discovery.
Hasn't he eaten?
No, I tried to slip trays of food under the door, but they don't fit.
There's only one thing that will fit, a package of Carnation Instant Breakfast.
You're right, let's try it.
Professor, we've brought you some breakfast.
How many times do I have to tell you? I don't want any greasy bacon, cold eggs, and soggy toast all squashed under my door.
But Professor, this is different. Just listen to what's in it. Sucrose, sodium silicoaluminate, sodium ascorbate, ferric orthophosphate,
yum, yum.
Riboflavin, pyridoxine hydrochloride.
I never realized how hungry I was.
Give it to me.
Wait, Professor. You have to mix it with milk.
What's that? Supersaturated homogenized calcium lactose.
Why didn't you say so?
Carnation Instant Breakfast. Lots of delicious flavors. Just mix a package with supersaturated homogenized calcium lactose.
What's that?
Start on your day.
And if a brand didn't have a connection to the space program, it just linked itself to the mission any way it could.
Your Coca-Cola Bottling Company congratulates the lunar astronauts.
Apollo 8 was the first mission to break free of Earth's orbit and travel the 250,000 miles to the moon. In a historic moment, on Christmas Eve in 1968, maybe the most tumultuous year for America in that decade, with rioting, the Vietnam War escalating, and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy occurring within 9 weeks of each other, the crew of Apollo 8 transmitted an image of the moon and took turns reading the first 10 verses from the book of Genesis.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
It was a contentious moment for some, saying the religious reading during a secular mission funded by American taxpayers was highly inappropriate. But polls showed the American public overwhelmingly supported the readings, no doubt remembering Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin's statement that, while up in space, he saw no evidence of God.
And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Excuse me, yes. Are you the man that invented the method for getting air to the moon when we get up there to live in God's great city, which he's constructing for us even now?
I'm not him, but I know him.
You'd probably know what I'm going to say.
Yes, I know. Go ahead and say it, because you could say it better than I can. I don't have much of a memory. I'm only psychic. I know what you're going to say, but then I forget.
I see, yes.
That's probably protective, you know?
You're the man that invented the long garden hose to the moon to get the air up there. Well, now look, you can tell me that... let me ask you this. Is a great city being constructed at this moment... which is called God's dwelling place in heaven.
Yes, mistress.
Well, there is such a place being built now, but the problem is that they started building it at the wrong address. They bulldozed down this lady's house, and she came out and said, "What are they doing?" This guy said, "I'm building God's kingdom," and she said, "You've got the wrong address."
This is terrible.
Spook and the blonde bombshell would often wash the big red convertible in the steep driveway, and for this purpose they employed, of course, the standard garden hose. This hose, it turned out, was key to Spook's plan for controlling the world. "When you get the guy on the moon," Spook once shouted to Ballinger over the shrieking chainsaw, and once was enough. "The guy's gonna need air!" Of course. A man had to live. A man had to breathe. Spook's solution was elegant and simple and based on modern technology, as modern as technology could be in the early 60s of the 20th century. If, he said, you had enough garden hoses and linked them all together, you could get air to the moon through them, and you would thereby conquer the moon, control women, control men, and eventually control what Spook liked to call the whole shooting match. The hose part of Spook's plan was unnerving to Ballinger. Spook was crazy, of course, and so his advice about women had to be taken with one or two cartons of salt.
Oh, beauty, go. Okay. Good day, welcome to our single. I'm Bob McKenzie, and this is my brother Doug. How's it going, eh? Beauty, eh?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay.
Okay, everyone, this record was my idea.
Get out!
It was. You're lying. He, Hosehead here, just sort of rid on my coattails.
Why are you doing this? It was our idea together, eh?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
We agreed to say that, but...
Oh, take off!
Singing, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good. Okay, so good day. Our topic today is music. That's right, like, because my brother and I are now experts in the field,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, right, because we're a band now. And, yeah.
Well, so, except for him. I'm a band.
Oh, how can you do that, making me look bad? You're such a hose hand.
Yeah, well, take off!
Take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way. Listen to this, it's coming. You know what it is?
What?
It's a drum solo.
Man on the Moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen,
Oh, jeez.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
She looked so helpless there, spread eagled on the floor. I beat the Eagle off and gave her a quick mouth-to-mouth resuscitation job.
Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
Then came the moment the world was waiting for.
Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The fact that you can navigate a quarter of a million miles through space and land on the surface of the moon, and then take off from the surface of the moon, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere with all the tremendous engineering challenges that that entails. Aerospace, in my view, was not really ready to do that. I think it's just a beautiful example of engineering overreach.
From the early days of the Mercury missions through the Gemini flights, all leading to Armstrong's lunar footprint, John F. Kennedy's goal was realized inside his stated time frame, 5 months short of 1970. It was through tremendous technical innovation and massive marketing and PR campaigns that NASA had achieved the near impossible. It had delivered the moon.
Houston, Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. We copy you on the ground. Now, let's see. We've got the auto-targeting fields. We've got a football-sized field crater here with a bunch of little guys playing football. A lot number of big boulders and rocks for about 1 or 2 credits. We have to move a P-66 in there and fly manually over that rock field, put down a 240 and lift up a few 30s. And there's another interesting-looking rock formation, 36, 20, 38, I would say.
Doctor, you've only got 20% of your oxygen left. You're going to have to come back into the tube. Doctor, you've got 15% of your oxygen left. You're going to have to make your re-entry now.
Give me another shock. Flash some more of those pictures.
Bill, do you think... Get him some more oxygen, Bill. Is there any way we can re-tube him?
There's no way. He is 10%. Lost.
He's lost. He's at 10%. He's at 8% now, Bill. Is there any way we can get some of those... Like, maybe we can get a mini-bubble to him and give him a Respro.
The only thing we can do from this end is to launch an Alpha and to try to get around the other side. It's possible we could break in, but I don't believe he has enough time.
No, he's only got a 4%. He's down to 4% now, and he's
well, there's a 4% warning light in front of me.
Larry, can you read that 4% warning light down there?
Houston, this is Tranquility Base.
Yes?
Fellas, did you just... Was that a cow?
Just a second. Did you say what's happening now, Larry?
Nothing's happening up here at all. There's a 4% on Charlie. I don't think he's going to be able to come down and get you. But aside from that, we haven't got anything to worry about here.
I got an, clear, Houston.
This is Charlie.
Charlie?
Was that a cow?
Charlie, I can't give it to you now. Sorry, Charlie.
The information on animals has been classified by order of the Defense Department.
I got a clear from Charlie. He got the retro light at 4%. He's coming back into the tube. I think he's going to be all right.
He is coming back.
Got some wonderful pictures, too.
That's really swell.
How was that laugh?
This is one small step for man.
I'm sorry, Neil. I do not copy. No steps for women?
One giant leap for mankind.
Do not copy, Neil. Leaping kind men? What about hopping mad women?
The moon does not appear to be made of green cheese, Houston.
Well, Mickey will be disappointed.
I'm planting the flag now. Wait a minute, Houston. You're not going to believe this. Under the dust layer, there appears to be... Can you get a chemical reading on this substance, Houston? It sure looks like cheddar.
We'll be right back to astronaut Neil Amid from the moon after this.
But where are the cows?
Roy Khan, a Zen master, lived the simplest kind of life in a little hut at the foot of a mountain. One evening, a thief visited the hut only to discover there was nothing in it to steal. Roy Khan returned and caught him. You may have come a long way to visit me, he told the prowler, and you should not return empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift. The thief was bewildered. He took the clothes and slunk away. Roy Khan sat naked, watching the moon. Poor fellow, he mused. I wish I could give him this beautiful moon.
Beautiful onyx sphere you rip off of the moon that watches you do it.
Right.